This week, the Israeli president says the country is on the brink of civil war because the current government is trying to make the Israeli Supreme Court powerless. So let's talk about judicial reform and how the long-time-coming crisis is really the occupation finally and fully biting Israel in the ass. I'm Lev Gringaus, and welcome to The Jews Are Tired, your podcast about Jewish news. As of the release of this podcast, it's day 393 of Russia's war in Ukraine. If you want to revisit what this war has meant for Ukrainians, Belarusians, and Jews, you can check out some of last year's episodes from this podcast. Number 72, Ukrainians are Jews now. Number 73, the Belarus connection. And number 82, my homeland is Ukraine. If you want to donate to help Ukraine, Ukrainians, and Ukrainian Jews, there's a link in the podcast notes with resources to do that. Okay, let's talk about Israel and arguably the largest democratic crisis the country has faced in 75 years. Proposed legislation to restructure the Supreme Court and the judicial system has army reservists, the backbone of Israel's army and security, saying they will refuse to serve. Banking and business leaders, as well as Israel's own treasury officials, forecast that Israel's economy will take a severe hit as foreign investors are scared off by the instability of an undemocratic nation. Both Israeli and American Jewish leaders say this judicial reform will strain relations further with the United States and with the richest and most powerful Jewish community outside of Israel. All while the Israeli president warns of civil war, and Israelis have been protesting in the hundreds of thousands across the country for the past 2 months. So this is obviously a big moment for the dream of a democratic and Jewish state proposed by the founders of the first Jewish state in almost 2,000 years. Although also, perhaps, just another footnote in the rise of illiberal right-wing movements around the world. This situation has been a long time coming, emerging from a mixture of extremist self-victimizing politics and the reality of a country that never created a constitution to clarify separation of government powers or checks and balances. It also recalls the fact that twice the Jewish people were cast out of the land of Israel because of our infighting, our hatred, and our egotistic, self-serving leadership. Nothing in our tradition says we can't be cast out again. So let's dive in to try and sort through what is going on. I hope this episode gives you a broader sense of the what and the why in all this. This episode will be split in three sections. Number one, the short-term context behind Israel's judicial reform push, aka why is this happening right now? Number two, the long-term background or how we got to this point, where we'll get to how the occupation factors into this. And number three, the legitimately conflicting nature of the Israeli Supreme Court, or wow, this is a pretty flimsy country with a lot of stuff to figure out. Normally, I'd put number three first, but most of this stuff is politically driven and not actually about the legitimate issues around the Supreme Court. There's a good amount of detail I am condensing into this episode, by the way, so definitely check out the podcast notes for lots more detail from all of the intelligent people who have written about and covered this stuff. So number one, what is this judicial reform push and why is it happening right now? Well, Israel has a right-wing, arguably extremist government led by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. You can check out episodes 87 and 88 of this podcast for more on that, but let's put it at that. Right-wing, religious, extremist government. But Netanyahu has a problem. He's on trial for corruption charges, and corruption charges, well, first investigations and then charges, are what ultimately brought down former Prime Minister Ehud Olmert back in the late 2000s. The difference is that Olmert resigned and Netanyahu is resolute in continuing to be Prime Minister. But if Netanyahu doesn't resign, and especially if his trial ends with him being ruled guilty, there's a chance that the Israeli Supreme Court could force him out of office. And he's already seen what that looks like because in January, the Supreme Court did kick a minister out of office. Aryeh Deri is the head of Shas, the ultra-Orthodox or Haredi party that represents Sephardic Jews from the Middle East and North Africa. Shas is an important part of Netanyahu's government, which is made up of several political parties cobbled together into one coalition. And in return for the support of Shas, Arya Dery was appointed by Netanyahu to run the Interior and Health Ministry. Problem is, Dery is a crook himself. He was convicted of bribery in 1999 and tax fraud just last year, where he got a plea deal because he gave the impression that he was going to quit politics altogether. He obviously didn't quit, participated in elections as the head of Shas, and here he was getting to be a minister of two extremely significant parts of the government. So several organizations actually petitioned to the Supreme Court against Dery's appointment, and the Supreme Court said, yep, this is unreasonable given Dery's prior convictions, and Dery also has to quit politics because that was a key presumption of his tax fraud case. That first part, unreasonableness, is one of those legitimately fuzzy legal doctrines where the court can say, wait, this government decision does not seem reasonable given the context and details, so we can overturn it. That's one of the bits that right-wingers are targeting. The second part is a common law doctrine called estoppel, I think I'm pronouncing that correctly, which says someone can't contradict themselves in certain legal contexts. In this case, because there was an understanding that Dery would quit politics, even if he didn't actually agree to it in any legally binding sense, he does have to stick by that understanding and therefore can't be serving as a minister. No one is trying to dismantle that doctrine, to my understanding. But what came out of this was the Supreme Court telling Netanyahu, you have to fire Dery. And he did. But this situation made painfully clear that if someone petitions the Supreme Court to say Netanyahu shouldn't be allowed to serve as prime minister because he is on trial, there is a window there for Netanyahu to be forced out of office, just like Dery. And in fact, some organizations have petitioned the Supreme Court to, at the very least, stop Netanyahu being involved in any legislation about the justice system, given he is on trial, and at most, to already say, yeah, toss him out, he's on trial for corruption. So how can Netanyahu, the longest-serving prime minister in Israeli history who is only looking for more, bypass this concern? Well, take away the Supreme Court's power and you don't have a problem. Or appoint friendly judges and you don't have a problem either. Or do both of those things. Without the Supreme Court, there is no government body standing in the way of the Knesset, Israel's parliament and the basis of its government, so the government can do whatever it wants, pass whatever legislation it wants, without any kind of check on its power. That includes stuff like passing a bill that says no court can remove a sitting prime minister, which, by the way, is going through the Knesset right now, or a bill that says the Supreme Court doesn't have the right to review cabinet appointments, which would allow Dery to rejoin the government. But the situation with Dery is when Israel really descended into chaos, because it was around that time in January when ministers in the current government outlined a legislative package that would overhaul the judicial system. This reform would make the Supreme Court useless as a check on the Knesset. Again, exactly what Netanyahu needs and wants right now. There are several proposals in that package that have shifted a bit over time, but there are two proposals really at the core of this legislative package. Number one, an override or notwithstanding clause, which are different versions of the same thing. If the Supreme Court ruled the law was unconstitutional, the Knesset could attach an override clause and pass the law anyway, ignoring the court ruling. The notwithstanding clause would preempt that by just saying, this piece of legislation is shielded from judicial review, so no court can do anything about it anyway. That's the most blatant power grab and the most obvious reason that Israelis have been protesting and criticizing this judicial reform, because it's so clearly just about the personal benefit of politicians like Netanyahu. The second core proposal is about changing the way Supreme Court justices are selected. Currently, justices are selected by a committee with four Knesset members, three Supreme Court justices, and two representatives of the Israeli Bar Association. Seven of the nine committee members are needed to approve a candidate, and politicians can't bring in a candidate without the justices on the committee approving those candidates. So there's a distinct balance between the political and judicial system, and some attempt at creating a consensus on justices, though obviously nothing is perfect in this situation. But under the judicial reform proposal, the committee that selects judges for the court would be expanded to 11 members, with six of the members, a clean majority, from the government coalition. The rest would be opposition politicians and Supreme Court justices. The idea is that as justices retire, the government coalition would be able to replace the first two justices with their simple majority. In other words, dibs on two justices being as right-wing or as extremist as this government wants. Other appointments would also need a simple majority vote, but the vote would have to include at least one opposition politician and one justice on the committee, so that would presumably have some actual oversight so that extremists don't just get a free pass. This is actually a more recent version of this proposal. Originally, the government coalition would have had total control over every judicial appointment. So this is being sold as a compromise, but it still amounts to the current government getting a lot of control over who gets to be a Supreme Court justice. Notably, the current Supreme Court president and several justices are slated for mandatory retirement soon, so this is being very deliberately timed. And speaking of timing, it's this second proposal about selecting judges that the government coalition wants to pass before Passover. So we'll probably see it become the law of the land very soon, and become a distinct way for the Israeli right-wing and Netanyahu to appoint Supreme Court justices that will turn a blind eye to undemocratic legislation. Legislation, for example, that would let a prime minister on trial for corruption stay in power. Now, it's notable that anyone with a brain can see that many of these proposals could also be used or misused by other non-right-wing governments down the line. Appointing justices is maybe the best way to bend the legal system long-term, but any change can be also used against the right wing, depending on what kind of government is in place. But it's also clear from election after election that Israel's left wing and center are washed out and struggle for consensus compared to the right wing. So comparatively for the right wing, it's not as much of a concern. Okay, let's now get to section number two of this podcast, the longer-term political background for how Israel got here. The first bit of this is related to something that has come up again and again over just about every episode I've done about Israel on this podcast and the never-ending cycle of elections the country has been stuck in. Since the country's founding, there has been a lot of tension in Israel between the secular aspects of the state and the religious aspects of the state, especially as defined by the ultra-Orthodox or Haredi political parties and parts of society. A recent flashpoint has been the Haredi rabbinate, which controls aspects of life in Israel like conversion and marriage. Many Israelis feel stifled by this, choosing to get married overseas rather than deal with the rabbinate. And non-Orthodox rabbis have been arrested for doing weddings outside the purview of the Haredi rabbinate, because non-Orthodox weddings are somewhere between unsanctioned, unrecognized, and illegal. But to the Haredim, this doesn't go far enough. How can a Jewish state be a Jewish state if it operates under secular ideas of law rather than Jewish law? And this is where you also get Haredi politicians trying to get all buses to stop operating on Shabbat, or for Israel to stop generating electricity on Shabbat, or for women who dress immodestly and read from the Torah at the Western Wall to face jail time. All of these have been real legislative proposals. But at the same time, Haredi politicians know that the Israeli Supreme Court stands in the way of those things. Their proposals are an obvious overreach that forces religious law onto Israelis who don't want it, or who may actively struggle without buses or electricity on Shabbat. In other words, they violate individual rights, which the Supreme Court has been intent on protecting. So the court would likely strike down those kinds of laws. So not only is there a bitterness that the Jewish state has a Supreme Court that doesn't stick to traditional Jewish law, but the Supreme Court in the Jewish state can, will, and has stepped in against implementing Haredi Jewish law for the entire country. The other factor in this is that many Haredi men study in yeshivas or religious schools, largely subsidized by taxpayer money. Those Haredi men are also known for not serving in the army, either getting exemptions or avoiding the draft. Meanwhile, secular Israelis who pay more taxes and do their mandatory service in the army feel that their money is getting sucked up by a bunch of people who refuse to defend the country but demand its money anyway. Haredi political parties have been trying for a long time to increase the amount of money going to yeshivas and to pass a law that gives Haredi men a blanket exemption from military service. A law like that could be struck down by the Supreme Court, so it makes sense to get the court out of the way entirely. No Supreme Court, and the Haredi parties would have an easier time trying to turn Israel into a theocracy. So the Haredim are pretty intent on these judicial reforms, but even if they have the will, it's another corner of Israeli politics that has really organized and paved the way for these judicial reforms. So now we get to the settlers and the politics of the occupation, which are really the driving force behind the judicial and democratic crisis. For decades, Israeli settlers have been gunning for the Supreme Court over Israeli policy towards settlements and Palestinians. In other words, Israeli policy towards its occupation of Palestinian territories. But let's take a step back for a moment, because the occupation and that phrasing is obviously a very charged kind of language for a lot of Jews. But we need to have some clarity here. Regardless of whether or not you agree with Jewish historical or religious claims to the West Bank or Judea and Samaria or whatever, however you want to call that place, what is happening there is a sovereign state controlling a piece of territory without officially attaching that land to itself. Israel has never annexed the West Bank after conquering it from Jordan, and regardless of how politicians talk, the government and judicial system and military recognizes that there is a military occupation of the West Bank by Israel. On top of that, again, regardless of whatever historical or religious claims you want to have about that land, there is a group of people, Palestinians, that live there, that have their own national aspirations, and Israeli settlers as a movement have been intent on making those national aspirations impossible to prevent a Palestinian state by claiming land and pushing Palestinians out with the blessing of the army and the Israeli government. There's infinitely more to say about that, but I'm not trying to litigate Jewish or Palestinian claims to that land on this podcast, nor am I trying to litigate what happens if Israel does annex the West Bank, nor is this a conversation about national security in Israel. But plenty of Israelis and American Jews have focused on how the current Israeli judicial reform is a threat to Israeli democracy without talking about settler politics and the occupation, both of which, by the way, have been fueled by American Jews. And the point is, if you're going to call something a threat to democracy, you have to be honest about where that threat comes from and what it will take to address it. So let's now get into it. Maybe the easiest way to understand Israeli settlers and their anger at the Supreme Court is through two events. The 1979 ruling that Elon Moreh, a West Bank settlement, had to be evacuated, and the Gaza disengagement in 2005. Elon Moreh was a Jewish settlement established in 1979 on the private land of a Palestinian village. That land, as was normal at the time, was seized by the Israel Defense Forces, Israel's army. Taking land in the West Bank and approving Jewish settlements on them was done in the name of security by the army. But Palestinian residents of the village that land belonged to sued in Israeli courts. And to the Israeli Supreme Court, the relevant details were that this settlement of Elon Moreh wasn't approved by the army due to legitimate security concerns. Instead, settlers had lobbied the army to approve this settlement, and then the army had done so. So because private Palestinian land was taken on political considerations, not security ones, the land seizure and the settlement were illegal. There's a Jewish Telegraphic Agency story about this ruling linked in the podcast notes, and here's how that story describes what the court said. Quote, "The view of the right of the people of Israel to the land of Israel is founded on Zionist ideology, but it does not justify the takeover of private property in an area which is under military government," end quote. What's notable is that Palestinian villages had been appealing land seizures since the early 1970s, but this is the first time an Israeli court sided with the Palestinians. And Elon Moreh, as JTA put it, was the first Jewish settlement dismantled by court order, and it would not be the last. To Israeli settlers, this ruling was a travesty. Here they are, fulfilling the dream of Jews in the historic land of Israel, reclaiming what God promised us, all while putting themselves and their families on the line in the name of Israel's security. And then comes this court, ruling by secular law, not even Jewish law, that says this settlement can't be here. But note also how self-victimizing this is, because Elon Moreh, yes, was dismantled. But it was then moved to another nearby piece of land in the West Bank that had been seized by the Israeli army, where the settlement continues to stand today. This contradiction sits at the heart of settler politics. They say they have been targeted. They say their rights have been taken away by the Supreme Court. At the same time, the Supreme Court and Israel's judicial system has overwhelmingly sided with the government, the army, and yes, the settlers on cases to do with Palestinians and the occupation. Remember again that Palestinians had been appealing IDF land seizures for almost a decade before this one settlement in 1979 was told, no, you can't be here. And then the settlement just picked up and moved nearby with the blessing of the army. There have been occasional rulings since then that certain settlements are illegal and have to be evacuated. And there's a 2015 story from the Christian Science Monitor linked in the podcast notes that shows a good window into how some of this has gone down and also how settlers politically think about the Israeli Supreme Court. In late 2015, there was a particular hilltop synagogue north of Jerusalem that the Israeli government had long said was illegal and should be demolished. But it was only when the Supreme Court finally said, okay, and here's an actual deadline by which you got to do that, did Israeli authorities follow through? The settlers obviously protested, with one banner reading, "The High Court hates God." Here's what one rabbi in the story had to say, quote, "It's inconceivable that a Jewish court will destroy a synagogue. It isn't legal. God doesn't permit it. The Torah doesn't permit this. This is a Jewish state," end quote. And here's how one settler activist boiled down his criticism of the Supreme Court, quote, "The Supreme Court doesn't promote a nationalist policy. It promotes a universalist policy that emphasizes human rights. It doesn't advance the national interests of the state of Israel. It promotes cosmopolitan, liberal, international interests," end quote. That same language and attitude has been echoed by all manner of right-wing advocates of judicial reform, casting themselves as the victims and the Supreme Court as a liberal dictatorship that has to be stopped. Meanwhile, if you ask Palestinians and the Israeli left, they'll show that the Supreme Court has mostly ruled against Palestinians, not settlers. Another settler grievance is with Israel's Gaza disengagement in 2005, when Israel unilaterally removed all Jews from settlements in the Gaza Strip. The government said it had a plan to resettle those Jews inside of Israel, but it really didn't and left those families struggling financially and emotionally with being forced out of their homes. And key to this story is the fact that the Gaza settlers appealed to the Supreme Court against the disengagement, and the Supreme Court decided not to get in the way. So to Israeli settlers, this is another very potent black mark against the court, and a situation that ties into the sense of victimization that settlers have. In broad strokes, this has led to Israeli settlers trying to take down the court's power, and settler politicians have been introducing some version of an override clause that would allow the Knesset to ignore the court since at least 2012. A couple more things to point out. Jewish settlers and their politicians are often Orthodox Jews, and there's a distinct religious bent to the mission here, given that it's about settling the land God gave to the Jewish people. And hewing toward a more traditional sense of Jewish law makes settlers good partners for the Haredi community in trying to take down the court. By the way, this is a broad generalization. I'm not saying all Orthodox Jews are inherently going to go along with trying to make Israel a theocracy. Also, not all Haredi Jews. It's just that this is a point of partnership for settler and Haredi politicians. It's also really important to note that both Israeli settlers as a movement and the politics around taking down the Supreme Court have been financially supported by American Jews for years. It is distinctly because of American Jewish support that political will translated to political way. Most notable in all this is the U.S.-based Tikva Fund, a right-wing nonprofit think tank and funding institution. The Tikva Fund is very secretive about its donors, but pretty open about its funding, which goes to right-wing Israeli organizations often tied to the settler movement. The Tikva Fund has been funding organizations like the Kohelet Policy Forum, a right-wing Israeli think tank that is credited with putting together the fundamentals of and advocating for this whole Supreme Court reform effort. It's their policy being enacted right now. Kohelet also started the Israel Law and Liberty Forum, which is the Israeli equivalent of the Federalist Society in the U.S., as a place to train in and organize right-wing lawyers, legal efforts, and judges. You can read more about this in a Moment magazine story linked in the podcast notes called High Court in the Hot Seat. The story is from 2021, but really dives into the background for everything happening right now. And lastly, I think there's no way to separate this legal effort by settler politicians from settler violence against Palestinians. It's a reality that Israeli settlers have gotten more violent, more often, over the past few years. To many, their actions have risen to the level of terrorism, and judging from settler rhetoric, they are trying to terrorize Palestinians. But it gets even better. According to the U.S. State Department, the Israeli army doesn't prevent most settler violence and rarely, if ever, holds settlers accountable for violence. And note that this goes hand in hand with government policy and how the Israeli government chooses to approach settler terrorism. And now this violence is coming home to take over the nest. Settler politicians like the extremist Itamar Ben-Gvir, who is currently the national security minister in this government, have been literally yelling at police to aggressively deal with the Israeli protests against judicial reform. It's not enough to attack Palestinians, they have to make sure Israelis are also beat down so there's no opposition. And by the way, the same American right-wing playbook is being used to delegitimize these protests, with Ben-Gvir calling the protesters anarchists and several politicians saying that the protests are paid for by international groups trying to destabilize Israel. Which, impossible not to find that darkly funny when it's really the Israeli right-wing that is being supported by international groups trying to destabilize Israel, in this case with the judicial reform. But the larger point that I want to make sure you don't miss is that Israeli settlers have grown as a movement and as a political force with the support and protection of the Israeli army, the Israeli government, and some very rich American Jews. They have gotten more violent and more intent on making Israel an extremist religious state where they can do whatever they want without consequence. Because again, that's what happens when you take power away from the Supreme Court. The Knesset, aka whoever is in government, can do whatever they want as long as they pass a bill. And keep in mind that rhetoric from settler politicians makes clear that if they do shove the court out of the way, that makes it easier for them to annex the West Bank and put together whatever policies they want to continue terrorizing Palestinians and even forcibly remove them from the West Bank. And yes, I am basically doing every bit of gymnastics, I can hear my lefty friends laughing at me, to avoid just saying that these guys would cement Israel as a fascist theocracy intent on apartheid at best with Palestinians in the West Bank and ethnic cleansing of Palestinians at worst. And if Israelis protest, well, Ben-Gvir is happy to get heavy-handed with them too. But you decide how you want to phrase all that with whatever considerations you have. But this situation, this judicial reform, is Israel's occupation of the West Bank come back to fully bite it in the ass. And we have to come to terms with that, and we have to be honest about it, because even if this crisis passes, settler politicians will still be there, and right-wing Israeli think tanks will still be there to push through next time they get a chance. And all of it's wrapped up in the fact that most likely the occupation will also still be there, driving these forces. In the grand scheme of things, Netanyahu is just riding this years-long wave because it benefits him right now and he needs it for his personal gain. There's also a lot to say about how American Jewish pro-Israel organizations and advocacy efforts have covered for this stuff. But go ahead and revisit episode 88 of this podcast from November for a deeper dive on that. Okay. Finally, we get to the last section of this podcast, which I guarantee will be much shorter than the rest, though in its own way, it's no less thorny. The even broader reality of all of this judicial reform talk is that Israel is operating on rubber bands and shoestrings. There is no constitution in Israel that clearly defines the checks and balances on power between the Knesset and the Supreme Court, or even the specific role of the Supreme Court. What Israel has instead are basic laws, which are semi-constitutional and generally define how the political system works. But what this has meant is that over the past many decades, the Supreme Court and the Knesset were always going to end up on some kind of collision course. That has been sped up since the 1990s when the Israeli Supreme Court went through their Marbury v. Madison phase. For those who don't know or don't remember, Marbury v. Madison is the United States Supreme Court case where the court decided on the basis of the Constitution that it can do judicial review of laws and statutes and strike them down. In a way, it was the court deciding for itself that it has a significant amount of power in balancing out the rest of the U.S. governmental system. The Israeli Supreme Court did basically the same thing in the 1990s. Bouncing off of a series of then newly passed basic laws about human rights, the court decided that it too can practice judicial review and strike down laws it sees as contradicting basic laws. As long as they aren't basic laws themselves, sort of, because different basic laws have different levels of authority, it's pretty confusing. Now, I don't know the details on how the U.S. decided to go along with Marbury v. Madison, but the U.S. at least did have a constitution that laid out the framework for how the court should work and also how the rest of the government should function and how the different pieces of government should relate to each other. Meanwhile, in Israel, basic laws are really just laws passed by the Knesset that the Knesset deems special. This isn't like a constitutional amendment in the United States where an amendment also has to be ratified by the states, and there's a distinct process and threshold for putting together and passing an amendment. In Israel, if the Knesset votes on it and there are enough votes, practically anything can happen unless the Supreme Court steps in. But when you have this system where the power dynamics and checks and balances aren't clearly defined, chaos is bound to happen, and that's also how we got here. There probably does need to be some kind of judicial reform to clarify the role of the Supreme Court in Israel. Just like there probably needs to be a constitution to clarify the Knesset's role. And look, several other countries like Great Britain don't have a distinct constitution either, but Britain has had many more centuries than Israel to have these kinds of crises and get past them and get more specific laws in place to balance out how things are supposed to work. These are the growing pains of a young country. So the Israeli right wing is taking advantage of this situation where legitimately something's got to give. I mean, it's not even clear if the Supreme Court has the power to strike down a basic law. So if the current government passes its judicial reform as a basic law, we don't know if the Supreme Court will try to review that legislation or strike it down, or what happens if they do strike it down, or if this current government will listen to that ruling. You get the idea. This is a mess. And until there is some kind of constitution or more time for more basic laws to define this stuff, this opportunity to shut down the Supreme Court's power will always be there. And more democratic crises are bound to happen as these governmental bodies continue to clash. So it's a very weird situation. There's a link in the podcast notes to a proposed constitution from the Israel Democracy Institute, a think tank that surveys and analyzes Israelis and Israeli democracy. So check that out if you're interested, but it really doesn't seem like any of that will be adopted in the near future. As for what happens next, take whichever bet you want. This government and the people leading it are very intent on kicking the Supreme Court out of their way. At the same time, there's no way to ignore that Israeli society is vehemently against these proposed reforms, and sometimes even extremists are only willing to go so far. I mean, they are still elected officials, so they can't piss people off too much, so maybe they'll back down. Or we might end up with some middle ground where the government passes some reforms but says they're a compromise because the reforms don't totally box in the Supreme Court. And if it comes to that, I would just say, be wary of who is selling you compromise, because even compromise could be very bad for Israel's democracy. And maybe my brain is fried, which, spoiler alert, it is, but I have no idea how to end this podcast. I've had no idea what to really say or think while watching this all go down in Israel. Hopefully this episode gave you a better understanding of the judicial reforms and how we got here, but where we go from here, as with anything in Israel, you're never going to predict it, so we wait and see and simmer on what a shitfest this is. And for those of us who care, we also hope that Israel's democracy and its people can withstand such a blatant attack and that things don't come to civil war. If only because I couldn't bear to watch American Jewish leaders helplessly blubber themselves into a coma over how to respond to an Israeli civil war, let alone deciding who to support. Also, civil war would be terrible. In case anybody needed me to say that and they didn't get the joke. Oh, yeah. This has been this week's The Jews Are Tired podcast. I'm Lev Gringaus. Don't forget to subscribe and share, and hopefully next week, the Jews will get some rest. The Jews Are Tired is a product of Jewfolk, Inc. For more information, go to tcjewfolk.com or email the show at podcast@tcjewfolk.com. A link to the transcript of this episode is available in the podcast notes, along with links to any news, stories, or reports referenced for this episode.